All right, we're beginning here on the bottom of Kuchav Bed Amud Bed, two lines from the bottom. Tara Banan. The pasuk says in Parshat Ki Teitze, Latet Lo Pishnayim, to give him a double portion. That's how we normally read the terminology. The truth is, that's probably not the meaning of the words in the Torah. The Torah says that when an individual has two children, the younger child is the more beloved child. He's not allowed to favor that child over the birthright of the Bechor. And he has to give the Bechor, ki et Bechor ben asnua, yakir, he'll identify, letet lo pishnayim, bechol asher yimatze lo, ki hu reishit ono, lo mishpata bechora. He has to give him pishnayim. So we loosely translate pishnayim as being double the portion. The truth is, that's probably not the translation of the word. You can see that in the psukim in Zechariah, as well as there's good evidence of it by Eliyahu and Elisha. When Eliyahu and Elisha are walking and Eliyahu is about to go up to the Shamayim, the request that Elisha makes of Eliyahu is, I want Pishnayim b'nevuatcha. I want double your nevuah. That's not a reasonable request to make of his Rebbe. How can he make a request of his Rebbe that I should have double what you have? First of all, it's chutzpah. But even leaving that aside, how is Eliyahu going to bestow upon him double what he has? So Pishnayim, the truth is, and in the context of what is found here in the Parsha of Ki Teitze, Pishnayim does not mean double, but rather Shnayim mitoch shalosh, two-thirds. Because you have two individuals over here, and when he gets Pishnayim, means that he gets two portions of the portions that are going to be divided amongst these two individuals. The two individuals, the Bechor and the Pashut, you divide it into three portions, and when you divide it into three portions, he can get Pishnayim. He gets two out of the three portions. The truth is that Pishnayim actually, in Tanakh, means two-thirds. That leads to a problem over here, which is, what does the two-thirds mean in this situation? You could read it in one of two ways, the two-thirds. By the case that is mentioned in the Torah, no nafkamina. The problem comes up when you change the dynamics. In this case, two-thirds is both two-thirds of the total possessions of the father, as well as two portions of the three portions that are divided out. But as soon as you expand the number of individuals that are there, for instance, there are four brothers, including a Bechor. So now you have three Pshutim and one Bechor. Now, how do you divide up the assets of the estate? Does the Bechor get two-thirds of the assets? And then the one-third remaining assets are divided by the other three brothers? Or do we say that they divide it up now between the four of them, five portions, because the Bechor gets a double portion, and then the Bechor will get two of the five portions, and then the remaining three portions will divide up to the Pashut. Those are the two ways you could read it, but it's not clear, because in the case of the Torah, the two portions of the Bechor are also two-thirds of the assets of the father. So from the case in the Torah, it's unclear, and that's what the Gemara here is speaking about, exactly that safek. Tana Rabbanan, Latet lo Pishnayim. Pishnayim ke'echad. Doesn't mean he gets twice as much as any other person would have gotten, as the one person would have gotten. Ata omer pishnayim keachad. Oh, eno lo pishnayim b'chol nechasim. Or does it mean that he gets, quote unquote, a double portion in all of the assets? Or in essence, he gets two-thirds of the assets. No matter what or how many brothers there are, he will always get two-thirds of the assets. The remaining third will be divided amongst the other brothers. V'dinu, chelkoim echad, v'chelkoim chamisha. When he divides with one, and he divides with five. My chelkoim echad, pishnayim keechad. Just like when he divides with one other brother, he gets a double portion, double the portion of that single brother. So too, when he has five brothers, he should also just get an additional portion above what the other brothers got. Or maybe it should go the other way. He divides up with one brother, he divides with five brothers. When it comes to dividing up with one brother, he gets two-thirds of all the assets. So too, when it comes to dividing up with five brothers, he'll get two-thirds or double the assets that the remaining brothers get. He gets a double portion. The assets are divided into three parts, and the third that goes to the other brothers, he's getting now double that portion. It's just vis-a-vis all the other brothers, not just one of those brothers. Tamalomar. So now the Gemara brings a number of rayot to show us which way you should learn, which is that the pasuk over there says, "Vaya biyom hinchilo et banav, haTorah ribta nachala itzalachim." The pasuk of Vayabon Yechilo et Banav et Asher Yelo, there the Rashbam claims that that pasuk is extraneous. And given the fact that it is an extraneous pasuk, we can learn from that that it is coming to Ribta Nachala, that give more Nachala to the other brothers. And because of that, the other brothers will take more than just one third of the assets. They will take all of them their portions, and the Bechor will only get a double portion divided up amongst all the brothers, not that they will get double of the assets vis-a-vis all the other brothers. So it'll be double portion, not two-thirds of the assets. The way that the Rabbeinu Gershom writes it is, Ela Torah Ribta Nachala Yitzalachim Klomar, Derova Nachala Teitzalachim. He says, from this pasuk you see, Vayav Yom Echilot Banav, Banav in the plural, Banav is not just the Bechor, that when he gives over his Yerusha to them, that should be the majority of the assets, should go to the other brothers, or to all of the brothers. The only way that happens is if the Bechor doesn't take two-thirds of the assets. Otherwise, there's only one person taking the majority of the assets, and that is the Bechor. So that's the way that the Rabbeinu Gershom learns it. Again, the Rashbam simply learns it, that the Pasuk of Vayah B'yom Mimchilo is Krai Yitera, because already afterwards it says in the subsequent Pasuk, Yad Bechor Ben Ashnoya, Kir Lo Te Lo Pishnayim. So what's the necessity for this Pasuk? Is to teach you that the Bechor only gets double portion, not two-thirds of the assets. Ha ena lecha ladon, k'lishon acharon, ela k'lishon rishon. And therefore, in the Braita, the two options we offered you, you should favor the first option and not the latter option, which is the first option was that it is a double portion, and not the latter option, which said that you get two-thirds of the assets. Ve'omer, and an additional proof to this is, ubnei ruvein bechor Yisrael, ki hu ha-bechor. B'nei Ruvain, who is the Bechor of Yaakov, because he's the Bechor, u'b'chalalo yutzei aviv, and after he profaned the bed of his father, nitna b'chorato l'b'nei Yosef ben Yisrael, the Bechor was transferred from Ruvain to Yosef, v'lo lehityaches la'bechora, but not necessarily for him to be called the Bechor. The way that the Rashbam writes it is, de lo'olam Ruvain kari Bechor Yisrael, because Ruvain will still carry the title of Bechor, even though he may not get the rights of the Bechor. The way that the Rabbeinu Gershom reads it is, De'id lo lahavi Bechor mamash, dehalo efshar. You can't change the facts on the ground. Yosef can never be the firstborn. Ruvain will always be the firstborn, so you can't change that fact. Ve'omer, and it continues, Ki Yehuda gavar be'echav, ulenagid mimenu. Yehuda rose above his brothers in order to be the leader, Vabechora le Yosef. And the firstborn went to Yosef. It's a pasuk in Divrei Yamim. The Targum also by the Brachot of Yaakov in Parshat Vayechi speaks about how the Bechora was redivided or redistributed, which is that a Bechor gets privileges in a number of areas. One is leadership, that it comes and manifests itself in two areas. One is Malchut, and the other one is Kehuna. They also get a double portion. And so what the Targum points out over there, and the Pasuk in Divrei Yamim makes some note of this, is that different portions of that were taken from Reuven and given to others. The double portion went from Reuven to Yosef. The Malchut went from Reuven to Yehuda. The Kuna went from Reuven to Levi. It stayed with Reuven up front, but later on, in the time of the Egel, is transferred from Reuven or the Bechorim to Leviim. And the shame or the title of Bechor remains with Reuven, or the fact that he is the firstborn can't be changed, and that remains with Reuven. So Nemra Bechora Yosef, v'Nemra Bechora Dorot. It says that by Yosef over here that the Bechora was to Yosef, and we have Bechora that's mentioned here in the Parsha of Ki Tetzeh. We're drawing a parallel between them. Ma Bechora Amura Yosef Pishnayim Kechad. Just like the Bechora by Yosef was a double portion, not two-thirds of the assets, similar to the other people's portions. Af Bechora Amura LeDorot, Pishnayim Kechad. So too, the Bechora LeDorot is a double portion, not two-thirds of the assets. So you have the word Bechora used in both places. As the Rashbam points out over here, this can't be some sort of Gzeirah Shavah, because we have a general principle, which is Divrei Torah, Midivrei Kabbalah, Lo Lomdim. We don't learn from the Navi about things that are in the Torah. It's one thing to make Gzeirah Shavah in the Torah, can't make Gzeirah Shavah from the Torah to the Navi. But rather, as the Rashbam points out over here, it is a Giloy Milta. What you can do what you can use the Navi and the Ktuvim for is defining terms, giving you a definition of a term that is used in the Torah. Over here, the Torah uses the term Bechora, Lo Mishpata Bechora. What is the Bechora mean? So the Navi gives you a definition of Bechora through the example of Yosef. So it's not a Gzei Reshava, it's not a Limud Legamre, because of Divrei Torah, Midivrei Kabbalah Liyafina, rather it's a Guloi Milta. It's defining a term for you, and that you can get from the Navi. Ve'omer. And now we have a third proof to this. Ani natati lecha shchem echad alechecha. I gave you, it's not clear what the pasuk means, we're going to assume what the Gemara is saying here is, shchem echad alechecha means I gave you an additional portion above your brothers. Asher lakachti miyad ha'emuri b'charbi u'b'kashti. That I took away from the emori, b'charbi u'b'kashti, with my sword, my bow, which means the bow and arrows. Is it possible that Yaakov took it away with his sword and with his bow? Balok van Ermar. Doesn't it say by David HaMelech, Ki lo bikashti eftach, v'charbi lo toshieni, that I'm not going to rely on my weapons of war, even though David is a warrior. He says that it's not kochi v'otzim yadiyah salat echay lezeh. It's not me and my weapons that win the battle, but rather a Kadosh Baruch Hu. Yaakov is not known for his status as a warrior. Certainly over there, he's not going to boast that he got it b'charbi u'b'kashti. It doesn't make sense that he's telling Yosef, that's how I got a hold of this. Ela charbi zo tfila, kashti zo bakasha. But rather, the word charbi is to be defined as tfila, and kashti zo bakasha is from the word bakasha. Now, by kashti, you could actually see it in the word, the letters themselves. Bikashti has the word bakasha embedded in it. Whereas by cheriv being connected to tefillah, the Marsha points out over here, akol kol Yaakov, v'yadayim idei Esav. That the kol of Yaakov was compared to the yadayim of Esav. And by the yadayim of Esav, the bracha that Yitzchak gives him is, arachar becha techyeh, that you will live by the sword. So just like by Esav, he lives by the sword of Yaakov is Akol Kol Yaakov. When you compare Yaakov to Esav, then the cherib of Esav, when you look at it through the prism of Yaakov, is Tfilah. Because that's Akol Kol Yaakov, which is contrasted with the Yadayim de Esav. So that's how you get to Tfilah. And Bakasha is associated with this. Now, the Pasuk itself is difficult, even without the Charbi or Koshti, the Pasuk is difficult. Because if it is speaking about Shechem itself, he says, I'm giving you Shechem, which does fall out. Shechem is part of the Yerusha that Yosef got in Eretz Yisrael. But the problem is that Shechem was conquered by Shimon and Levi, not by Yaakov. And Yaakov was critical of what Shimon and Levi did over there. So when it says here, Natat lecha Shechem achecha, conquered by Charbi Kashti, it's very hard to understand the Pasuk. Because if you're speaking literally about Shechem, then how could it be that Becharbi Kashti, he wasn't the one who conquered it. It was conquered by his sons, the brothers of Yosef. So the Gemara says, you can't take the Pasuk at face value. First of all, because Becharbi Kashti, Yaakov wouldn't be boasting about. And I'm adding in, B'Shechem Echad Alechecha is very difficult to understand. So Shechem here must be an additional portion that you're going to get. Now, the way that the Rashbam explains over here is, what was the tefillah that he engaged in order to get this bichora, which was that he had to daven in order that he would get the dina bichora, that Yaakov would be awarded the Yerushab, the bichor, which was Eretz Yisrael. And that's what he's saying to him. Through my tefillot, I was able to gain the land of Israel, because then I was deemed as the bichor of Yitzchak, and I became the chosen party to continue that lineage of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, who were promised the land of Israel. And that was through my tefillah. That's the way that the Rashbam explains it. Sheitbalel Yaakov abanav, v'shazachah liknot b'chura me'isav b'tefillato. So Yaakov davened for his children. So that would maybe, the Rashbam is hinting at, the association to Shechem itself, that he davened that his children will be successful in the conquest of the land. V'shazachah liknot b'chura me'isav b'tefillato. My ve'omer. So now, after we've now discussed the whole Braita, Gemara wants to understand why the Braita had to bring three proofs to the fact that the Bechor gets a double portion and not two-thirds of the assets. V'chi teima. So this is the reason why. Hi, dele Rabbi Yochanan ben Brokahu da'ato. We saw yesterday's daf. We're going to see him upcoming in the Mishnayot later on. that maybe the Ve'ayah b'yom hichilo et banav, you said that was extraneous according to the Rashbam. By the way, the Rabbeinu Gershom said it favored giving the majority of the assets to the other children. Maybe that is not available for that drasha, because Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka further on uses that pasuk to teach you, Ve'ayah b'yom hichilo et banav. The hanchil is an active verb. Yerusha shouldn't be passed actively. It's a passive passing of property. Because when the person is niftar, passes away, then the property automatically goes to his yorshim. Sounds like there's an active verb, that you are morish the property to your children. So from that, Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka learns, and we saw this again at the end of yesterday's daf, that you have a right to distribute the property to whichever of your yorshim you choose. But there is one corollary to that. It has to be b'yom chilo et banav, someone who is ra'ui li yorsho. Has to be somebody who would have otherwise been a recipient of the Yerusha. He's allowed to redistribute the assets amongst them. So if he has three children, then the three children would have garnered one-third of the assets of the estate had he just passed away and done nothing. He has the right then to give 100% to one of those children, 50% to one, 25% to the others. He can redistribute the allocations of the Yerusha. That's the view of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. But he uses the pasuk vayom b'yom chilo et banav to learn that. If you do that, then it's not extraneous anymore to teach us that the bechor gets a double portion and not two-thirds of the assets. First proof that the Braita brought, but the Braita says, if you want to undermine that proof by saying that Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, if you hold like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, then you can't say that, tashma. Then you have the pasuk from Divrei Yamim. Ubnei Ruvein bechor Yisrael. Bechita iman, if you want to say bechorami bechorato lo yigam rinan, that the words are not exactly the same. Because it says by Ruvein, nitna bechorato levnei Yosef ben Yisrael. The bechorato was given to him. The word in Parshat Ki Tetzeh is bechora. So maybe that's not a quote-unquote gezeirah shava. Even though throughout Shas, we don't always ask for exact words to be used in terms of creating gezeirah shava. Sometimes we do, but most times we don't. Over here, it might be needed because it's not really gezeirah shava, as the Rashbam pointed out. It's a giloi milta. If you're defining a term, then you better have the right term being defined. Bechorato might be different than bechora. And if that's the case, you haven't defined the term bechora because it's a different word that's used in Divrei Yamim. So tashma. So if you don't like that, v'abechora leYosef. The remaining part of the pasuk says abechora leYosef. So it has the word bechora used explicitly. And therefore now we can draw the gilui milta of bechora. V'chita ima Yosef kufe mimai de pishnaim kecharaba. And if you say, how do you know that Yosef got a double portion? Tashma, v'nata ani natak lecha shchem echad alachecha. I gave you an additional, here it means shchem would mean shoulder. I gave you a shoulder. I gave you something above and beyond what the other brothers got. That is the way that you term somebody who is head and shoulders above someone else. When in Navi describes Shaul HaMelech, it describes him as being someone whose shoulder was above the heads of everyone else. Meaning it gives a description like that. And similarly over here, Shchem Echad Alechecha means that you will stand taller than all your brothers, or you'll get a portion above that which your brothers got. Who says that he gave him an additional portion that was equal to the portions that the other brothers got? All it says is that he got, he's the shoulders above his brothers. That means he got more. It doesn't mean that he got double portion, just means he'll get more than his brothers got. That could be even one palm tree. It could even be a small piece of land. He just gave him extra land. So Amalei Alecha Markra. He says, for you, the pasuk says, Ephraim u'Menashe k'Ruvein v'Shimon i'Yuli. That Ephraim u'Menashe are equivalent to Ruvein and Shimon. So that means that Ephraim u'Menashe get a portion just like Ruvein and Shimon. That means that he got a double portion in Eretz Yisrael. Now, the Rashbam over here asks, why didn't the Bright itself bring this pasuk to finish off? And that would have made it absolutely clear. The Rashbam says that the Bright takes it for granted that you know the psukim in the Torah. The psukim in the Torah, in the context of where this is written, in that same parshiyah where he says, Shechem Echad Alechecha, the beginning of that perek says that Ephraim u'Menashe k'Ruvein u'Shimon i'Yuli. He says, anybody who knows Torah will know that the double portion means a double portion literally, and not just a little more than the other brothers, because of what's said in the psukim there. So Rashbam calls it Zil Kari Be'Rav. Go to Cheder and you'll know the answer to this question. It's not something that the Braita needs to spell out explicitly. Bar minei Rabbi Chelbo mi Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmani. Mara Ayakov, shnatal bechura muruvein, v'natna liYosef. What did Yaakov see that he felt justified in moving the Bechura from Reuven to Yosef? Gemara says, Mara'a? What do you mean, what did he see? Ubechalolo yutzei aviv k'tiv. The Pasuk in Divrei Yamim makes it clear that it was cause and effect. Reuven did something wrong. He profaned his father's couch or bed, and therefore he lost the Bechura. So the question of why Reuven lost the Bechura is not really a fair question, because the Tanakh spells out exactly why. The question is not about why Reuven lost it, the question is why did Yosef get it? So, the Ma Davar Domeh says, I'll bring you a parable to what this is similar to. The Balabayit Shigidel Yatom B'toch Beito. A Balabayit who takes in an orphan into his house. Liyamim He'eshir Oto Yatom. After a certain period of time, the Yatom is very successful and becomes very wealthy. Va'amar, and ninu the balabayit minichsai. Let me take care of the balabayit who helped me all along with my assets. Meaning that here is a foster parent who took in an orphan. The orphan goes on to become very successful. The orphan goes back to the foster parent and takes care of the foster parent because of what that foster parent did for him all those years in bringing him up. So it's a quid pro quo, which is the Yatom, out of his gratefulness for what the foster parent did, takes care of the foster parent later on, as if they were a parent, and gives them back in that way. Similarly over here, Yosef is the Balabayit, Yaakov is the Yatom. Because when Yaakov comes down to Mitzrayim, Yosef sustains the family. It says, V'chalkel Yosef, that Yosef sustains economically the whole family down in Mitzrayim, including Yaakov. So then, at the end of his life, Yaakov wants to repay Yosef and give him a return for the fact that he had taken care of him all of these years. So what does he do? He has a bonus. Because Reuven, in some sense, was discredited from the Bechora, and now he has an extra portion of land to distribute. So he hands it to Yosef as repayment for all the goodness that Yosef had done for him in Mitzrayim. Amalei, v'ilav dechata Reuven, lo mahani le de Yosef, lo midam. It seems a little strange, because that means that if Reuven never sinned, Yaakov would never have given anything to Yosef. It doesn't seem right or doesn't sit right. That's number one. Number two is, as the Rashbam points out over here, Yaakov didn't give anything of his own to Yosef. What Yaakov was giving belonged to the brothers, or belonged to another brother. So all he did was redistribute something that belonged to the brothers of Yosef. He didn't give something that belonged to himself personally to Yosef. He just gave something that belonged to Reuven to Yosef. So what do you call that? That he's mehanehim? Ella, as the Rashbam says, vadai. Vadai, Yaakov gave of his own property and money to Yosef. And that's what he says here. Vadai mishalom tanlo, hein mimono. He gave him additional cash and presents. Hein brachot. And also in the brachot, he gives a double portion to Yosef, or gives extra to Yosef, because he gives the brocha to Ephraim and Menashe. Aside from the brachot that he gives to all of the children, he gives an additional brocha that's specifically for Ephraim and Menashe. So that's where Yaakov gave of his own to Yosef, both from his assets, not talking about Eretz Yisrael, as well as from the brachot that he had to distribute, he gave a bonus to Yosef. But then we still have to understand, why did the Bechorah move from Reuven to Yosef? Ella, Rabbi Yonatan Rabbeich, lo kach amar. So he says to him, Rabbi Chelbo is one querying of Rav Shmuel bar Nachmani. Rav Shmuel bar Nachmani, all over Shas, quotes his Rebbe, Rabbi Yonatan. So here Rabbi Chelbo is saying, didn't your Rebbe, Rabbi Yonatan, say this? Ruaya haita bechora letzeit mi Rachel. The bechora should have emanated from Rachel, dichtiv. Ele todot Yaakov, Yosef. That these are the offspring of Yaakov. These are the generations of Yaakov. Yosef. Yosef was the primary offspring of Yaakov. The truth is that you don't even have to bring it that way. You could just bring the initial intentions of Yaakov, which is that originally when he went to marry the daughters of Laban, he meant to marry Rachel and not Leah. It was only because of what Laban did that he switched it around. So it would have been that Rachel was the first wife and Yosef would have been the firstborn. Ella, she could have mata Leah birachamim. But Leah got ahead of the line. She cut the line because she had more rachamim. She had already beseeched Hashem. Because of the tremendous tzniut demonstrated by Rachel, Hashem brought back the bechorah that went to Leah to Rachel. Ma'kad mata Leah berachamim. This is one of the most famous agadot. Anybody who's gone to kindergarten or elementary school has been told these agadot. And here's the source of it in the Gemara right here. Why did Leah come before Rachel berachamim? Dichtiv. Because it says, Ve'inei Leah rakot. That the eyes of Leah, rakot means rach, means soft, so that can't be what it means, but it probably means, or literally means, that her eyes either were dim, or that her eyes, there was something wrong physically with her eyes in terms of their appearance. So my rakot, ilema rakot mamash, if you think there's some sort of physical deformity or some impairment in her vision, efshar bignut be'imat me'ah lo dibera katuv, the pasuk is not even willing to say something negative about a non-kosher animal. Dichtiv, because the pasuk says, mina beima Torah, umina beima asher enenu Torah. It says that the animal that is tahor, that is kasher, and the animal that is not kasher. It doesn't phrase it as beima tmeya, but rather as beima asher enenu Torah. If you remember in the first parak in Psachim, the Gemara learns from that you have to always speak b'lashon nikiya. You always have to speak in a proper and clean choice of words when you communicate. And one of those examples is exactly what we brought here, that the Torah added on letters, words in the Torah, in order not to say behemat meah, but rather to say behemat she'enena teora. Bignut tzadikim divera katuv. We won't even speak about a behemat meah that way. It's going to speak about a tzadik or tzadikah, like le'ah, and say about her that there's some sort of physical deformity in her. Elamar Rabbi Lazar, shematanotea arukot, that her gifts were very long. They hear the way the Rashbam explains it, long means they have lasting duration. The gifts that she was given lasted forever, and those are the gifts of Kuna, Leviyah, and Malchut. All of those emanate from Leah, and so the gifts that she was granted were arukot, were everlasting, because the Kuna, Leviyah, and Malchut all emanate from Leah. Rav Amar Lolam Rakot Mamash. That no, literally, it means that there was something wrong with her eyes. V'lo Ganayhu Ula. And it's not something that is negative or insulting towards her. Ela Shevach Ula. It's something that is praiseworthy in nature. Shaita Shomat Al Parshata Derachim. She used to hear on the local roads. B'nei Adam Shayu Omrim. People were saying, Shnei Banim Yeshla L'Rivka. Shtei Banot Yeshla L'Lavan. Brothers and sister, here you have Lavan and Rivka, or brother and sister. Rivka has two sons. Lavan has two daughters, first cousins. Gdola legadol, biktana lekatan. They probably are going to get married. It was very common in those days to marry intra-family. Especially we see with the Avot, with Avram who sends back to his family to get a wife for Yitzchak. And similarly, Yaakov takes his wives from the family of his mother. So here, again, you would assume that there is going to be some sort of marriage between the families. And so now if you line them up, you would say that the eldest son would go with the eldest daughter. The younger son would go with the younger daughter. Vaita yoshevet al pashat rachim u'mashelet. She would sit out there and say, Gadol ma'masav. What's the story with the person who's going to be my shidduch? The older brother, what does he do? Ishrahu. He's a terrible person. Blastein briyot. He is a marauder. He robs the people. Katan mamasav. What's the story with the younger brother? Ishtam Yoshevo Alim. So he is a simple individual who sits in the tent, meaning that he is a man of the Beit Midrash. Vaita bucha. She cried, Ad shenishru risei eneha. She cried so much until her eyelashes fell out. And that's what's being described over here. Ve'nei Leah rakot. They were soft because they were missing their eyelashes. But that is a praise to her because she cried so much over her fate that her eyelashes fell out. And that's what's meant in the pasuk. Hashem saw that Leah was hated. Now, what does it mean that Leah is hated over here, that snua Leah? It can't mean literally that she was hated because the pasuk says that Vayehav Yaakov et Rachel mi Leah. Yaakov loved Rachel more than Leah. But if you phrase it in that way, there is some sort of hierarchy that Rachel is more loved and Leah is loved, but less loved than Rachel. But yet Hashem says, or why Hashem gives rachamim to Leah and she gives birth is because Vayar Hashem kisnu Leah. My snua. Ilei masnua mamash. If you think that she was literally hated, efshar b'gnut beimat meya lo diber hakatuv, b'gnut tzadikim diber hakatuv. Torah doesn't even willing to speak negatively about a non-kosher animal. It's going to speak negatively, whether it's about Yaakov here, who hated, quote-unquote, Leah, or Leah, who had the sensation of being hated. Ella, ra'a, kosh baruch hu shesnu'im ma'aseh esav bifaneha. So here's the drasha. What does it mean, ki snu'a Leah? Not that Leah herself was hated, but rather that Leah rejected the shidduch that was going to be read, the shidduch with her and Esav. Because snu'a ma'aseh esav bifaneha, v'yiftach et rachma. Therefore, he granted her the first child, and that's why she was entitled to the Bechura. So that's the Rachamim that brought about the firstborn coming from Leah. Because Leah had cried so much and begged Hashem that her lot should not fall with Esav. Hashem granted her wish, and she was married to Yaakov, and she bore the firstborn from Yaakov. Umayt tzniut hayta ba b'Rachel. What was the humility or the humbleness that came from Rachel that won back the Bechura for her? Dichtev, vayeged Yaakov to Rachel, ki achi aviyahu. Yaakov, when he meets Rachel, says that I am your father's brother. V'chi ben Rivkahu, that he was the son of Rivka. Those two are incompatible. How could he be the brother of Lavan and also the son of Rivka? Rivka is Lavan's sister. If he's a son of Rivka, then he's a nephew to Lavan, not the brother of Lavan. The truth is that the word ach is used in the Torah, not necessarily to mean brother literally, but to mean a family member. And many times in the context of nephew, it's used in that way. You have it by Abraham and Lot. He also uses the term achim, ki anashim achim anachnu, because we are brothers. And over there also, Abraham's referring to his nephew, who is his brother. So Balo ben achot aviyahu, wasn't he the son of her father's sister, meaning nephew? And so, and the Pashtut, achi means nephew or means family member, but here the Gemara is darshaning that he literally meant achi. El amrala, minsibitli, get married to me. Amrale, in. She said, no problem, we get married. Miu, abba rama'ahu. My father is a thief, or a trickster cunning. Velo yachotle, and you're not going to be able to overcome him. You're not going to win in this game. Amrala, my ramute. What is his trickery that he uses? I have an older sister. And he's not going to marry me off before he marries her off. That's what Lavan says in the end. We don't do this in our place to marry off the younger daughter before the older daughter. And we saw a couple of daf ago that the Rashbam and then the Bach brings that down halachically. That there's a requirement to marry off the older child before the younger child. So that's what it means, I'm his brother. I'm a peer of his when it comes to trickery or cunningness. Is it really possible or mutar for a tzaddik to get engaged in this type of trickery and deception? All right, so he says back there, in, yes. Because the pasuk says in Shmuel, im navar titabar, with the one who is pure, act purely. But if the person is corrupt, then you can act perversely, in that you can reflect the behavior of the party that you are engaged with. There's an interesting, if you look here in the Meiri says that it's chas v'shalom, that a tzaddik is allowed to engage in any type of business transaction or any type of interactions that involve trickery, deception, or cunning. It's only as a defensive measure that the person can do it. If he's going to be taken advantage of, then he's allowed to defend himself or use it as a defense mechanism. But he cannot use it as an offensive mechanism, and he cannot use it in order to establish his business or act in general. So he's very careful to note that this is not permitted, or people shouldn't take from this that trickery and deception are a way of doing business. It's only if the other parties are going to do that and take advantage of you, then you need to do something to defend yourself, or so you should make yourself known that you're wise to these things. That's fine, but not that you should engage in this type of activity. Similarly over here, we're going to see that none of this actually plays out in terms of what Lavan did and what Yaakov's response. Lavan is, in this sense, trying to trick Yaakov or deceive Yaakov and giving him Leah instead of Rachel. We're going to see that Rachel intervenes, and that Yaakov never really does anything in order to trick Laban back. We're going to see that now. Masar la simanim. That Yaakov, in order to prevent that problem, gave over simanim, signs to Rachel that she could identify herself so that he would know for sure that it was Rachel. So he didn't really act with trickery or deception back against Laban. He just did something that would make sure that he wasn't being tricked. So maybe that is exactly what the Meiri is pointing out, that Yaakov just used a defensive measure. He wasn't trying to trick Laban. He was using something to protect himself over here. But that doesn't really play out in the pasuk of deception versus deception. Some want to say that Yaakov says, I already know how to act this way because that's how I got the Bechura from Esav. I had to do something deceptive in order to do that. So I'm already well versed in these types of people and how to deal with these types of people. I already have past experience. The truth is that Yaakov, in a sense, comes in there as an innocent. And even if this is true, Chazal putting words in his mouth, that he's saying, I can be as good a trickster or deceiver as Laban. In the end, Yaakov gets swindled over and over and over again by Laban. He thinks that he's on par with him, but meantime, Laban is swinging him around for all those years that he's there. That's number one. Number two is, from the psukim themselves, it's not clear whether Rachel and Leah knew anything about what had happened. The way the Chazal presented over here, that Yaakov asked Rachel for a hand in marriage, and then this old conversation takes place where Rachel and Leah are party to what's happening over here. The truth is, in the psukim, it's not clear that Rachel and Leah are aware of anything that's going on. Yaakov and Laban are negotiating about which daughter he marries, and then which daughter is placed there is up to Laban. So it might be that Leah and Rachel had no clue that Yaakov had negotiated for Rachel, and then Yaakov, when he brings Leah to be the wife, Leah has no idea about what the agreement was between Yaakov and Laban, and in a sense, she was an innocent victim of her father's deception. So in the Torah, it's not clear at all that Rachel and Leah are party to this. Here in the Agadot, according to Chazal, they are players in the whole scenario. It's a very common tactic that the Midrash uses in order to make parties active in situations where the Torah doesn't give them an active role. For instance, by Akedat Yitzchak. By Akedat Yitzchak, the only active party in the Torah is Abraham. Yitzchak is completely passive in Akedat Yitzchak according to the Torah. On the other hand, the Midrash Chazal bring Yitzchak into the Akedat Yitzchak by explaining his role there, an active role in there, asking his father, what are we going to bring? I'm ready to be shechted. I'm giving up my life. They have all these things that they add in to make Yitzchak an active party there. So similarly over here, Rachel and Leah, the Torah, are not active parties to the situation. Here, Chazal and Midrash add that perspective into the whole story of Yaakov and Laban, that Rachel and Leah are active parties. So he gave her simanim. When they were bringing Leah into be the woman that he was wedding, Savra, Hashta Michsefa Chatai. My sister is going to be embarrassed here because Yaakov's going to know it's not her, and it's going to cause a whole hullabaloo. Misartinu Niala. Rachel gives up. It's tremendous Mesirat Nefesh. She gives up the Simanim to her sister in order to prevent her sister from being embarrassed. She gave up the love of her life. She gave up the Bechorah. She gave up so many things in allowing Leah to be the one married to Yaakov. And it's not even clear at this point whether Rachel will marry Yaakov once she gives it up to Leah. We know later on that he marries both of them, but that wasn't necessarily at first what was going to happen. That's why it says, when Yaakov wakes up in the morning, all of a sudden he realizes it's Leah. How did he not know the night before that it was Leah? How come only in the morning? Until this point, he did not assume it was Leah. But because Rachel disclosed the secret signs between her and Yaakov to Leah, then Leah seemed like Rachel until the morning when he wakes up and he realizes it's not Rachel, but it is Leah. That's the answer to the question about why the Bechura was passed from Reuven to Yosef. Is because Rachel was the one entitled to the Bechura, both because she was the first one who was supposed to marry Yaakov. That was overtaken by Leah because of her davening to Hashem and the rachamim that she beseeched from Hashem in order to protect her from having to marry Esav. But then Rachel won it back with her tremendous Mesirat Nefesh when she gave over the simanim to her sister and didn't allow her sister to be embarrassed in this situation. So therefore, it's originally awarded to Rachel. But then when Reuven loses it, it's given to Yosef. But that is nothing to do with the mashal that we had before. The fact that Yaakov wants to reward Yosef, that comes out of his own pocket, his own money, and his own brachot that he gives. With regards to the land, that is something that comes through what the Torah prescribes over here. It was awarded to Reuven at first, the Bechor of Leah, and then Hashem gave that to the, gave it to Yosef because of the scenarios that played out over here. So then when Reuven loses it, it's passed to Yosef because of this reward that Hashem wants to give to Rachel for her behavior in this situation. Baimine Abba Khalifa Kruya mi Rabbi Chir Ba'abo. Abba Khalifa Kruya asked this question of Chir Ba'abo. Bichlan atam motzei shivim, bipratan atam motzei shivim chaser achad. In the total count, you find 70, and in the enumeration, you only find 69. The psukim say that there were 66 individuals, plus Yosef, Ephraim, and Menashe as an additional 3, and the total is 70. So it adds up to 69, and it tells you 70. Now, the bigger problem is actually not in that pasuk, but in the psukim earlier. By each of the wives and shpachot of Yaakov, it enumerates the numbers of offspring that were produced. So by Leah, it says in the enumeration, she has 32 offspring. But then when it goes to the total number, it says she has 33. So that's actually where the bigger problem exists, is that over there it's giving you an exact number. And instead of saying 32, it says 33. I think it's the Ebenezer who points out that with regards to the 70, it's not as big a deal, because the Torah always rounds numbers to the nearest 10. So if it's later, even if it was 69, it says 70, you're not going to make such a big deal out of that, because that's just a round number. Okay, like 70. 69 is almost 70, so you just call it 70. But the problem is that if the number is 32 and you say 33, you can't call that rounding. That's a number that's exact, and it's got an extra one. Now, once you say that, then the 70 and 69 problem arises again, because it really would have been 70 if it was 33 instead of 32. So that's the question. Amrlei, so he answered him, so how do you get this extra individual into the 70? Tomai, Taim, and Dina. Dina had a twin sister that was born with her, Dichtiv, Be'et Dina Bito. So the Et is a reboy, so that not only was Dina, but Et Dina Bito. That's also the way Chazal darshan by Kayin Behevel, that there was a twin born with Evel, because Be'et, over there, and as well as the fact that, Umar is going to say now, Eli Me'ata, Tomai Taim Binyamin, you're going to say that Binyamin also had a twin born with him. Tichtei Be'et Binyamin Achiv Benimo. Over there it says that Be'et Binyamin. So you're going to say that's a reboy, his brother through the mother. That's a reboy. Also to say that he had an additional brother. So that can't be the explanation. The Baal Yitosafot themselves say, Tiyomai Taim Binyamin Uba'alma Amrin and Tiyomai Taim Kol HaShvatim. Wait a minute. Doesn't old Chazal say that there were twin sisters born with all the Shvatim? Rashi on Chumash tries to deal with that problem in the list of 70 over there. He says, what happened to all the twins that were born? So he says, they all were niftara, they were all passed away before that point in time. That's one way to deal with it. Or, wives were not counted. So that's another way to deal with it. But it is a problem according to that Midrash Chazal. So either they all passed away, or they're not counted for whatever reason. Chazal obviously have this problem because the Torah specifically states, Vayered Yehuda Me'echav, Yehuda leaves his brother and goes down and then marries someone from the Canaanites. We know that Canaan was Arur, and Avram refused to allow Yitzchak to marry anybody from Canaan. So how could it be that the Shvatim married the women of Canaan? Because who else were they marrying when they lived in Eretz Yisrael? It's full of the seven nations who are going to be wiped out. Who were they marrying? So the answer, according to Chazal, is Teoma, that there were twins born with all the brothers, and that's how they married someone within the family. Again, it's a Midrash Chazal to try to deal with that issue or that problem, because Yehuda is designated or singled out for his behavior in marrying someone from the local population of Canaan, which seems to imply that the other brothers did not do that. Obviously, it could be that it just wasn't significant by them, because Tamar's story is very important. But the other brothers, whoever they married, they were just regular wives and regular stories. It's not mentioned. But that's the issue that brings up that Midrash Chazal that Tosfot is mentioning. Amar, so he says back to him, Margalit Tova Haita Biyodi, Vatamekesh Labdami Meni. I had this precious jewel pearl in my hand, and now you're trying to get it away from me? So the way that the Rashbam, the Rabbeinu Gershom, sealed it, Klamar, Atar Rutzeh Shomer Lecha V'Yedau Akol. This is something that I had, that's like a really good dvort that I have over here, and now you want me to tell it to you, and now everybody's going to know about it? Then it won't be mine anymore, and then it's going to be known to everyone else. The way the Rashbam says it, because Umikara, the Chudehu Debai, why didn't he tell him the answer up front? Because he wanted to sharpen him. He wanted to think about it and try to get the answer. And then why did he tell him it was a pearl that he's going to lose?
He was trying to get him excited about the reason. He's trying to get him excited about what he's going to learn. He says, I have this precious thing that now you're going to take away from me and everybody's going to know about it. So the person gets excited to hear, what's this thing? What's so special that he has to say? And he'll remember it better because of that. That's the way it's said over here. My brother-in-law pointed out that the Gemara in Chagiga on Daf Gimel Amud Aleph has a similar expression about Margalit Tova Itab Yodi. Or the, over there, it's Haytab Yadchem, that you had a precious pearl, and it's used in the opposite direction over there. Over here, it's the person who has the vort is saying, I don't want to give up this pure pearl that I have. Over there, the individual is saying, you didn't want to tell me this vort? You're going to keep this pearl and not share with me this wonderful pearl of wisdom that you had. So actually, you see it in both directions here, this idea of pearl of wisdom, that holding on to a Torah thought, or a Torah chidush, is called a pearl. And when you disclose it to others, then you're, in essence, losing the pearl. Over here, it would be losing the pearl because he's giving it to the other person. Over there, it was losing the pearl because he did not give it, that he did not receive the Torah. But it's an expression that's used for Chidushei Torah. But again, it's used in order to make it exciting and to speak about these pearls of wisdom that come out of the Torah. So, Hachamar Rabbi Chamar Bachanina. So this is why this is brought over here, is because of the answer. Zo Yocheved Sholata B'derech V'Lidita Ben Achomot. This refers to Yocheved, who was conceived on the way to Mitzrayim, or conceived before they left for Mitzrayim. V'Lidita Ben Achomot, she was born right as they enter into Mitzrayim. Shenemar, as the pasuk says in Bamidbar, in the census, Asher Yalda Utala Levi B'Mitzrayim, that was born to Levi in Mitzrayim. Why is that information important? First of all, of course, if she's the daughter of Levi, she was born to Levi. And why is it B'Mitzrayim? Leidata B'Mitzrayim, Beino Rata B'Mitzrayim. She was born in Mitzrayim, but she was not conceived in Mitzrayim. And according to this part, Midrash Chazal, the 70th person that's over there is Yocheved. Yocheved, who's born as they enter into Mitzrayim. She's not in the enumeration because she wasn't Miyordei Mitzrayim. She didn't descend down to Mitzrayim. She came down to Mitzrayim as an ubar, as a fetus in her mother's womb. But then she's born. Once they reach Mitzrayim, it says there that once they reach Mitzrayim, they have 70. So if you're Midayek in the Lashon of the Pasuk, it says those that were Yordei Mitzrayim, that is 69. Once they reach Mitzrayim and they have Yosef Banav and Yocheved, that's how you get to 70. So that's the Midrash Chazal. The Rishonim over there in the Torah give other answers to this question of who is the 70th individual. But here the Gemara brings the Midrash Chazal of Yocheved, which we just saw, we just brought before in the Gemara, this same Midrash back on Kufchof. So that's why this is associated. Since it's connected, they bring it over here as well. Barmine Rabbi Chelbo and Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmani. Tiv, it says, Vayik asher yelda Rachel et Yosef. Once Rachel gave birth to Yosef, then Yaakov is ready to leave the house of Laban. The truth is, the reason he's ready to leave the house of Laban is because his time's up for his work, and now he's ready to leave. So that's why he wanted to leave. But the Pasuk specifically connects it, Vayi Kasher. Once Rachel gave birth to Yosef, Yaakov's ready to leave. What does it have to do with Yosef? He's leaving because he's done with the 14 years of work that he had promised Laban. So this is it. Maishnaki et Yaled Yosef. What was unique about the birth of Yosef? Amalei Ra'ay Yaakov Avinu Shein Zarosh Alei Sevnim Sar Labiyad Zarosh Alei Yosef. That only into the hands of Yosef will the offspring of Esau be given. Shenemar, because the Pasuk says in Ovadia, Vaya Beit Yaakov Eish, Yaakov will be, the household of Yaakov will be a fire, Ubeit Yosef Lava, and the Beit Yosef will be a flame, Ubeit Esav the Kash, and Beit Esav will be like the straw. Straw is something that's very flammable. The fire is Yaakov. How does the fire get to the straw to lick up or to burn the straw? That's through the flame. So Yosef is the mechanism for the conquest or for the overcoming of Esav. So therefore, as soon as Yaakov has Yosef and he sees that benevuah, he says, I'm ready to go home and face Esav now because I have Yosef on my side. This parak in Ovadia is the haftorah for Parshat Vayishlach for this exact reason. Because of the fact that this pasuk that we read over here, Yaakov's confrontation with Esav is because already that he has Yosef on his side. And this, what you're going here in the Midrash Chazal over here is what precipitates the fact that that is the Haftorah for Parshat Vayishlach. Eitave, is that really true? That whenever you faced off against the Zera of Esav, that it was done through Yosef. Now we have great examples of that. We have in the Midbar, Yoshua, who is from Shevet Ephraim. He's the one that goes out to battle Amalek in the Midbar. Also, when we go into Eretz Yisrael, Shaul HaMelech is asked to fight Amalek as well. So you see that the Zera of Yosef, or really it's really Zera Rachel, because Shaul is from Shevet Binyamin, is also someone who is asked to fight against Amalek. And later on, Chazal also bring it with regards to Mordechai versus Haman. That Haman is a descendant of Amalek, and Mordechai is a descendant of Binyamin. He's also the one that faces off against Haman. So you see this again and again in history. Is it really true that only the Bnei Rachel are really the ones that defeat Esav? Don't we have a pasuk, Etvei? Pasuk by David HaMelech. After Amalek overruns Ziklag, which was the city of David HaMelech when he's running away from Shaul, where the wives and the children stayed, Amalek comes and overrides it, plunders the place, and takes all the women and children with them. So David goes after them to kill them. And he says, Vayakim David, man neshef ad erev demacharatam. So David fights with them, meaning neshef, it's not clear whether neshef means twilight, in the sense of right before nightfall, in the zone between day and night, or it means dawn in the twilight of the morning, which is between the dawn and the sunrise, that period of time. Either way, David fights with them for a period of time until the evening, the macharatam of the next day. So over there he defeats Amalek, and of course David HaMelech is from Yehuda. So Amalek dakrich nevi'i lo akrich tuvei. Says you might be well versed in the Navi, but you're obviously not well versed in Ktuvim. You're quoting me a question from a pasuk in Navi. The pasuk in the Ktuvim answers your question. Dichtiv, the pasuk there says belechto al Ziklag. When David went to Ziklag, naflu alav, they joined him. I mean, he has a ragtag team that works with him, David HaMelech. He's not a formal army. He's like a militia. And he has a ragtag group of individuals that joined him. Amongst those individuals are Mimenashe. Those individuals from Menashe, Adna, Viozavad, Vidael, Umichael, Viozavad, Velihu, Vitziltai, Roshe Alafim, Asher LeMenashe. So you see here that there were a group of individuals from Menashe that joined David's militia, and that's why they were able to defeat Amalek, because he had people from Menashe with him. So it's not that he did it alone, but he had someone from Yosef that joined him. Meitei Rav Yosef. What about the other story in Divrei Yamim in Perek Dalet? Umehem Bnei Shimon. There were a group of individuals from Bnei Shimon. Alchul Har Seir. Anashim Chamesh Meot. There were 500 people from the Shevet of Shimon that went to Har Seir. Uplatia, Unearia, Urefaya, Vaaziel, Bnei Ishi, Berosham. Vayaku et Sherita Pleita LaAmalek. They wiped out the remainder of Amalek. Vayishu Sham at Ayom Hazeh. And they lived there until today. So over there you have 500 men from Shimon that go to Har Seir, which is the area of Edom, but Amalek, who's a descendant of Esav, he is the son of Eliphaz, the son of Esav. And you see that Shimon went out and defeated them. Shimon's a son of Leah. Where is anybody from Bnei Rachel over here to help out? So Amar Rav Rashila, Ishi bin Bnei Mashe Ati. Then the list of individuals that there amongst the Chamesh Meot, says Uplatio Naria Rafaya Vaziel Bnei Ishi Berosham. The children of Ishi, or Ishi, was at the head of them. And it says here that Ishi was from Bnei Mashiati Dichtiv. Because it says, Ubnei Menashe Chefer Vishi. Well, guess what? As you can look up in the old Gimel in the Mesorah Dashas, Lo Matzati, there is no such pasuk that was quoted here by the Gemara. This pasuk does not exist at all. Rather, there is a pasuk, as the Masorah Shas notes over here, there is a pasuk in Perek Hay of Divrei Yamim, pasuk Chav Gimel Chav Dalet, and over there the psukim read the following: Ubnei Chatzi Shevet Menashe Yeshvu Baretz Mi Bashan Vad Bal Chermon Usnir VaHar Chimon Heimaravu. So half of Menashe who took their chelik in Eber Yardain, they live in the Bashan until Chermon and the Har Snir or Har Chermon, which is the area, as today is known as the Golan. So that's where they are. Ve'ele roshei beit avutam. These are the heads of the families of Bnei Menashe. Ve'efer ve'ishi. So that's probably what they were referencing over there. First of all, it's not chefer, but rather ve'efer. And then it says ve'ishi. So that's probably the reference that Chazal over here, they just do it in short form. They don't quote the pasuk itself. They're just telling you that you have Bnei Menashe that are efer, not chefer, but efer and ishi. Even though that's not exactly what the pasuk says. So that's also there again, you have from Bnei Menashe that are joining Shimon, and that's what allows them to defeat Amalek. Tan Rabbanan, Habchor notel pishnayim bizroa ublechayim ubekeba.
the Bechor of a Kohen. Kohen is entitled to the Matnot Kuhuna. One of the Matnot Kuhuna is the Zroa Lechaim and the Keba. These are the parts of an animal that is Chulin, when you shecht it, that you have to give to the Kohanim. We'll spend more time in Kodashim dealing with this, as well as why today we don't give the Zroa Lechaim and Keba, which is not such a simple issue to deal with, and is a problem that has to be dealt with properly in terms of the slaughterhouses, what they do about the Zroa Lechaim and the Keba. But nevertheless, if a Kohen would get the Zroa Lechaim and Keba, his son, who is the Bechor, will get a double portion of that. Ube Muktashim, similarly in Kodshim, the son, the Bechor, will get a double portion. Ube Shevach, Sheshibchu Nechasim, Nachar Mitat Aviem, as well as the appreciation of the assets of the estate after the death of the father, the Bechor gets a double portion. Ketzad, please explain to me. Eniach L'chaim Aviem Para Muchkeret Umuskeret B'yad Acherim. If a father left a cow that was rented out to others, or muhkeret, was used by others in a sharecropping manner, which means that he paid them a fixed fee for per year, and they shared in the output or whatever this cow created. The difference between them might be muhkeret is that they got cash payment, and muhkeret would be that they got payment in produce or in kind for what it was. B'yad Acherim, Oshaita ro'ah be'efer, or the cow was out grazing out in the public areas. I mean, it wasn't a private property, it was just grazing out there. Be'alda, and it gave birth. Bechor notel pishnayim. The Bechor gets a double portion in that. Aval, on the other hand, banu batim, v'natu kramim, ein Bechor notel pishnayim. On the other hand, if they built houses with the money of the estate, or they planted vineyards, the Bechor does not get a double portion. Trying to explain what's the difference when the Bechor does get a double portion and when he does not get a double portion. He gets a double portion when something's already in motion, it seems, but something that is done after the death of the father, he does not get a double portion. Again, the Gemara here is going to go through each of these sections of the Braita. Now the Gemara goes back and says, please explain to me what was just said in this Braita, because it's very hard to understand any one of the lines that or halachot that the Braita gave. Please explain to me how you have a Zroa Lechaim and Keba where the Bechor gets a double portion. If the father already received that as a Kohen, as a gift, before he died, then it's obvious he's Mukhzak in it. Why should the Bechor not get a double portion? Pshita. If it yet to reach the hands of their father, Ra'oihu. And we already know that a Bechor is only entitled to a double portion of the assets that are in possession of his father, not those assets that come to him after the death of the father. If it's after the death of the father, then it was Ra'oi, who said that was coming to him, but nevertheless, it wasn't his yet, the Bechor doesn't get a double portion. Or if they're giving it because of the children of this individual, then certainly he doesn't get a double portion in it. And we already know that a Bechor only gets a double portion in the assets that are possessed by the father, not assets on the come. So halacha, the case here is b'makirei kihuna askinan. We're dealing with a situation in which this individual was the kohen or the designated kohen for these families or for these relatives. That's what the way that the Rashbam says it. She'elu o'avav gamru umaknulo amatanok she'adayim betoch ha'beima. That his relatives, his close friends, they already give him possession of the matanot inside the animal. They already designated for him because he's their kohen. He's their man, and they always give it to him. And it was already shechted in the lifetime of their father. Because sabar, and they hold matanot shelo urmu k'mishu urmu damu. And matanot that have yet to be taken off are as if taken off over here. So now you have three things that make it that this item is muhzak with the father, even though it did not reach his hand before his death. One is that he's makirei kuna. He was the designated kohen for these individuals. Number two is the animal was already shechted, which makes now that they are available, these matanot are available to be given. And the third thing is that even though the matanot have yet to be separated out, they're considered as if separated out. Now, each one of these items we have to discuss. The first one is matanot shalohumu kamishahumu damien. If you look here, it's very difficult. You can see that in the Masorah Shas. The Tosafot over here points it out as well, which is that Rabbi, who is the author of this Braita over here, is of the belief in other Masechtot
that we do not say that. We don't say that matanot, like shumot and masrot, shelo hurmu, that weren't taken off, are gerumu damyan. So how come all of a sudden over here, Rabbi is of the opinion that they are considered to be as if taken off? So he says, that's where, v'yesh lamar, t'tana acha, lo sover leke Rabbi, ela baha. That this Tana holds like Rabbi in one aspect, doesn't hold like Rabbi in the other aspect, that's one way to deal with it. But the more important is the second answer of the Tosfot, inami. Which is, dafka b'matot shumot maser itle the Rabbi delav k'mishu mudami. It's different. Shumot and masrot are very different than matnot of zro lechaim and keba. Because, aval matnot ha'ocha, zro lechaim she'en nikarot, itle k'mishu mudamia. When you tell me what shumot and masrot and produce, there's nothing that physically distinguishes the shumot and masrot from the chulin, or when you have tevel and it's all mixed together, there's no way to differentiate what is going to belong to the Kohen and what is going to remain chulin. It's all based on what you separate. Over there, Rabbi says you can't say that which is not separated is as if separated. There's nothing here that makes it like separated. Right? There's nothing that distinguishes it. On the other hand, by Zerah L'chaim and Keba, it's known up front what's going to be taken off. Kamish Urmadami, it's not a big deal there because these are distinct parts of the animal and you don't have to do anything. You know which parts of the animal are going to go to the Kohen. So that's the way that the Balei HaTosafot answer, and if you look in the Masorah Shas in Otched, he says that in the Gemara Kedushin, Nira Lehejia, Desfirle the Rabbi, Tekamish Umar Dami. He says that if you look in the Gemara Kedushin, it seems that which Tosafot is speculating about over here is explicit in the Gemara and Kedushin that Rabbi thinks they are Kehumu Damian. So that's one issue. The second issue is the Ishtachit B'chaye Avon. It has to be shechted in the lifetime of their father, which is that it's not enough that it be that this is a makirei kuhuna. This is someone that they always give this stuff to. It has to be already reached the point where they are worthy of being given, which is only after shechita is an obligation to give them. There's no obligation to give them before shechita. So he can't make a claim on it before there actually is an obligation to give it to him. That's number two. Number three is makirei kuhuna. Makirei kuhuna, what type of obligation is associated with that? Here you have a machloket rishonim. It actually goes back to the Gemara in Baba Metzia. So there are two ways to formulate it. One way to formulate it, which is like the Balei HaTosafot say over here, b'chol duch da avin makirei kuhuna mukzak. All over Shas, whenever it speaks about makirei kuhuna, they're considered to be mukzakim, as if they possess the item itself. The afal pi, even though shimratza yechol lachzor bo, if he wants to retract, he has that ability, mikom makom. As long as he hasn't retracted the gift, it's as if he is in possession of it. That's all true. If it's only shecht, it has to be shechted in the life of their father, because otherwise, if it's after the life of their father that it was shechted, then it never came into the possession of the father. And if it came into the possession of the children, then it's certainly not shvacha de memela or something that the bechor should take pishnayim. So according to the Balei HaTosafot, the default status is that you are mukzak in it, but if the person actively changes their mind, they have a right to do so. Now then, the Rashbam speaks about it in terms of this being a definitive gift that at the time of Shechita goes to the individual as the makirei kuhuna, and you have an illegal ability then to go and extract it from them based on that Gemara in Bava Metzia, which says that someone who gifts something and it is of the size of gift that would be considered to be normal, there, like in the American law today, of concepts of promissory estoppel and detrimental reliance, you would be able to go to court and extract it, like we learned in the Gemara in Bava Metzia. So there are differences in the Rishonim as to how binding this aspect of makirei kuhuna is. According to some, the makirei kuhuna is simply a default option, but you can't opt out of it if you choose. According to the way the Rashbam is saying it, this is a mindset from the beginning, which means it's absolute. It's binding from that moment because that's what you think. Or that's what we assume you are thinking, and therefore you can't back out of it. And it's a binding obligation to give it to that Kohen. Right? So that's as far as that aspect of the Yerusha. And that's why the Bechor gets a double portion in it. Now, next thing is Kodashim. Mukdashim, Lavdi Deininu. When you're speaking about Kodashim, they don't belong to the Kohen. How can you say the Bechor gets a double portion of the Kodashim? Kodashim don't belong to him. Now, let's start. If you're a Makdish animal, while it's still alive, Kodshei Kodashim, there is Me'ilah, if you misappropriate, if you misuse it, it clearly belongs to Ekdesh, not to the Kohen. Even Kodshim Kalim, that are not subject to Me'ilah when they're alive, they still are not the Kohen's property. He can't get married with it, he can't use it for his own personal uses. It belongs to Gevoah. So now what are you going to say? After it's shechted on the Mizbeach, then the Kohanim get portions from the animal. Already, the Gemara tells us in Kiddushin that the basar and the gifts that come off the korbanot of the Mizbeach is Mishulchan Gavoa Kazochi. You're Zocheh from Hashem's table. It's not yours. It's only yours because Hashem allowed you to eat at his table. So there's nothing in the Kodeshim that really absolutely belongs to the Kohen that you could say here that he can give it to his son or they would bequeath it to his children that the Bechor would get a double portion. The answer to the Gemara is no. Bekodeshim Kalim, believe it to Rabbi Yossi HaGalili. It is Kodeshim Kalim according to Rabbi Yossi HaGalili who tells us the Amar Mamon Balimu. The Gemara in Kiddushin is exactly this issue that you can be Mekadesh and Isha with Kodeshim Kalim according to Rabbi Yossi HaGalili. Because the Aglili believes not only are Kodeshim Kalim not subject to Mi'ilah, they are Mamon Balim. They are owned by the Balim. So therefore, if Yisrael gave a Bechor to the Kohen in order to bring it up as a Korban in the Mikdash, then that Bechor that he gave to him becomes the Mamon of the Kohen because Bechor is Kodeshim Kalim. So according to Rabbi Yossi Aglili, it's so much yours, that monetary ownership, and when it's passed to the children, there's a double portion given to the Bechor, it's bequeathed to the children. The Tanya, how do we know that Kodeshim Kalim are Mamon Balim? Mala Mal Bashem, there are both Kodeshim Kalim. This is a pasuk that's found by the Asham Zelot, by a case where a person is Kichesh, he denies owing money, and then afterwards he admits he's caught lying about it. He has to then pay back the money plus a fifth and bring a Korban Asham Zelot. In the Psukim over there, it says one of the things that he did was Umala Mal Bashem. It says that he did something, he did an affront to Hashem. But what affront to Hashem? He's stealing from his fellow man. The answer to that is very easy. Ma'al Baal Hashem is because when you steal from your fellow Jew, that's also a affront to Hashem. It's not just Ben Adam L'Chaviro, it's also a Ben Adam L'Makom problem. But the way that Rabbi Yossi Glili darshins it is, there's something that is a Ma'al Baal Hashem that is also included in this Hashem Zelot. L'rabot, Kodeshim Kalim, Shem Mamon Balim, Divi Rabbi Yossi Glili. Rabbi Yossi Glili says in those psukim there that if you lie about something that was owned by someone, for instance, Kodeshim Kalim, that's owned by the Kohen, you steal it and deny stealing it, you're going to have to bring in Hashem Zelot, because it's considered to be Mamon Balim. So that's how we deal with Kodeshim. Eniach lehem aviyem para muhkeret umuskeret biyad acherim, oshayta ro'a be'efer v'yalda. In that case, Bechor notel ba pishnayim. The Bechor gets a double portion. Hashto, now you told me muhkeret umuskeret ala b'shuta demaradid hu kaimo. In the case where it's rented out, or it's given out on a sharing basis, there where it's not in the possession of the owner, Amar Shakil, there you said the Bechor gets a double portion, Ro'a be'efer miboy, a case where it's just grazing by itself out in the field, you have to tell me that the Bechor gets a double portion, there it's still in the, technically in the possession of the estate, of course you should get a double portion. Hakamash Malan, no, that's what it's coming to teach us. It's paralleling these two cases to teach you. The mucheret umuskeret dumya deru'a ba'afar. What is the situation in which there's a rental or some sort of sharing of profits agreement whereby the Bechor would get the double portion when it is similar to the case of the animal grazing out in the public fields or out in the wild? Maru'a be'afar shvocho de memelo ka'ati. Just like the animal that is out in the fields grazing, it is appreciation that happens by itself. There is no investment needed over here, and there is no work being put into it. You're not feeding the animal. It's not costing you anything to keep this animal around. And in addition, the animal is giving birth to babies, producing without your intervention at all. That's what we call passive appreciation. That's something that happens by itself to the estate, and therefore it's considered to be a part and parcel of the estate, and that's why the Bechor gets a double portion in it. Af muhkeret umuskeret. Similarly, by the case of the profit sharing and the rental, shvocho de memela ka'ati de lo chasri b'mizone. It's also considered to be passive appreciation of the assets of the estate because you're there not obligated to feed the animal. All the obligations are on the party who is renting it or on the party who's going to give you the shared profits over there. You only just get the money that comes out of it. It is appreciation associated with the estate that has nothing to do with the yitomim or the children. It always has to do with what was already put in place by the estate, and therefore it's considered to be shvocho de memela. It's considered to be passive appreciation, and in that passive appreciation, the Bechor gets a double portion. Now, here, there is a major machloket rishonim as to when is something classified as passive appreciation. You can already see this in the Balei Tosafot, who say that, wait a minute, why over here did the Mishnah distinguish between building houses and planting vineyards? When they built houses and planted vineyards, we say the Bechor does not get a double portion. Because over there, they made effort to create the appreciation in the assets of the estate. The assets of the estate were there. Now they built houses, they planted vineyards. That's active engagement to increase the value of the estate. There, the Bechor does not get a double portion. So then, why did, instead of making the distinction between building houses and renting, make the difference between whether they're obligated to feed the animals or not feed the animals? In a case where it's rented out and they have to feed the animals, no double portion for the Bechor. In a case where it's rented out and they don't have to feed the animals, there is a double portion to the Bechor. So that's the Tosfot answer in the end, Yesh Lamar. Tahava mina mucheret muskeret gufa dechasri bei mazona davka in a Bechor notel pishnai mishum davei ro'oi gamur. In a case where you have to feed the animals, that's called ro'oi gamur. Deina shevach al gufa para. Because the shevach doesn't derive from the body of the para. Aval banu batim natu kramim she shevach al gufa karka. It's directly attached to the ground. Maybe the Bechor there should get a double portion, because even though it's something they invested, something they did, since it's attached to the karka itself, that's considered to be shvacha memela. So from here, the Rishonim have a number of nuances or differences that they note. First of all, when is rental income considered to be shvacha memela, and when is it considered to be an investment or an active appreciation of the estate? So from the Tosfot over here, it's pretty clear that he thinks that the rental income itself is considered to be shvacha de memela, although there are those that suggest that it has to be similar to the case of the ro'ah. That in the case of the ro'ah, the shvacha de memela is only when it gives birth to a baby, so too that which is muskeret de mukheret is only considered to be mukzak or shvacha de memela when it has a child or it gives birth to a child, not the rental income itself. Others say that both are meshvacha de memela, both a child born to the animal, as well as the rental income are classified as being shvacha de memela. So many want to note that it's only when the father had put the rental agreement in place, is it shvacha de memela. Because then it's just payments that are coming to the yatomim, they didn't have to do anything. But if the yatomim initiated the rental, maybe not in that case. Others say no, even if they initiate the rental, all they did was engage the cow now to be used. They have no obligations towards it, and that's considered to be shvacha de memela of the estate, because they don't have to do anything active in order to generate those assets. It's simply the assets of the estate are productive, and therefore they're getting the money. And similarly, by the beima ro'ah and giving birth to a child, some rishonim require that it already be pregnant before the death of the father. Others, and somewhat based on this Tosfot over here, suggest that the animal, even if it becomes pregnant afterwards, that's still considered to be shvacha de memela, because it's something that derives from the goof of the animal, and it's not something that they had to have any import or any effort in deriving that output. And therefore, it's considered to be shvacha de memela, even if it was not pregnant before the father's death, that's still considered to be passive appreciation of the estate, which the Bechor will have a double portion in. All right, we're going to stop here, two lines down on the top of Kuf Chav Dalet Amud Aleph.